Do you have in your wigwams or tents or skyscrapers or wherever you live?
Trailers without wheels, mostly,
said Artisan Quinn. Very well. In those, is it common to have things that can think but that are not human?
We did for a while, but they all stopped working and we threw them away.
Can you read? And by that I don't just mean interpreting logotype.
No one uses that anymore, said Quinn. You're talking about the symbols on your underwear that tell you not to use bleach, that sort of thing.
We don't have underwear or bleach. Just the bolt, the cord, and the sphere, said Fra Orlo, patting the length of cloth thrown over his head, the rope knotted around his waist, and the sphere under his bottom. This was a weak joke at our expense, to set Quinn at ease. Quinn stood up and tossed his long body in a way that made his jacket fly off. He was not a thick-built man, but he had muscles from working. He whirled the jacket round to his front and used his thumbs to thrust out a sheaf of tags sewn into the back of the collar. I could see the logo of a company which I recognized from 10 years ago, though they had made it simpler. Below it was a grid of tiny pictures that moved.
Kinograms, the obsoleted logotype.
I felt old. A new feeling for me. Orlo had been curious until he'd seen the kinograms. Now he looked disappointed.
Oh, he said, in a mild and polite tone of voice. You are talking bullshit.
I got embarrassed. Quinn was amazed. Then his face turned red. It looked as if he were talking himself into being angry. Fra Orlo didn't say what you think, I told Quinn, and tried to punctuate it with a chuckle, which came out as a gasp. It is an ancient Orth word.
You sounded a lot like...
I know, but Fra Orlo has forgotten all about the word you were thinking of. It's not what he meant.
What did he mean, then?
Fra Orlo was fascinated that Quinn and I were talking about him as if he weren't there. He means that there's no real distinction between kinograms and logotype.
But there is, Quinn said. They are incompatible.
His face wasn't red anymore. He drew breath and thought about it for a minute. Finally, he shrugged.
But I see what you mean. We could have gone on using logotype.
Why do you suppose it became obsolete then?
Asked Orlo.
So that the people who brought us kinograms could gain market share.
Orlo frowned and considered this phrase.
That sounds like bullshit, too.
So that they could make money.
Very well. And how did those people achieve that goal?
By making it harder and harder to use logotype and easier to use kinograms.
How annoying. Why did the people not rise up in rebellion?
Over time, we were led to believe that kinograms really were better. So, I guess you're right. It really is bull.
But he stopped in mid-word.
Well, you can say it. It's not a bad word.
Well, I won't say it because it feels wrong to say it here, in this place.
As you wish, Artisan Quinn.
Where were we?
Quinn asked, then answered his own question.
You were asking me if I could read, not these, but the frozen letters used to write Orth.
He nodded at my leaf, which was growing dark with just that sort of script.
Yes.
I could if I had to, because my parents made me learn, but I don't because I never have to,
said Quinn.
My son, now, he's a different story.
His father made him learn?
Fra Orlo put in. Quinn smiled.
Yes.
He reads books?
All the time.
His age?
Obviously, this was not on the questionnaire.
11. And he hasn't been burned at the stake yet.
Quinn said that in a very serious way. I wondered if Fra Orlo understood that Quinn was making a joke, taking a dig at him. Orlo made no sign.
You have criminals?
Of course.
But the mere fact that Quinn responded in this way caused Orlo to jump to a new leaf of the questionnaire.
How do you know?
What?
You say, of course there are criminals, but looking at a particular person, how do you know whether or not he is a criminal? Are criminals branded, tattooed, locked up? Who decides who is and isn't a criminal? Does a woman with shaved eyebrows say, you are a criminal and ring a silver bell? or is it rather a man in a wig who strikes a block of wood with a hammer? Do you thrust the accused through a donut-shaped magnet, or use a forked stick that twitches when it is brought near evil? Does an emperor hand down the decision from his throne written in vermilion ink and sealed with black wax? Or is it rather that the accused must walk barefoot across a griddle? Perhaps there is ubiquitous moving picture practice, what you'd call steely captors, that know all, but their secrets may only be unlocked by a court of eunuchs, each of whom has memorized part of a long number. Or perhaps a mob shows up and throws rocks at the suspect until he's dead.
I can't take you seriously,
Quinn said.
You've only been in the consent, what, 30 years?
Fra Orlo sighed and looked at me. 29 years, 11 months, 3 weeks, 6 days.
And it's plain to see that you are boning up for Appert, but you can't really think that things have changed so much.
Another look in my direction. Artisan Quinn, said Fra Orlo, after a pause to make his words hit harder. This is anno 3689 of the Reconstitution.
That's what my calendar says, too,
Quinn affirmed. 3690 is tomorrow. Not only the Unarian math, but we Decenarians as well will celebrate Appert. According to the ancient rules, our gates will open and we will welcome visitors for a period of 10 days. Now, 10 years hence, the Centenarian gate will open for the first and probably the last time in my life.
When it closes, which side of that gate will you be on? Quinn asked.
I got embarrassed again, because I'd never dare ask such a question. But I was secretly delighted that Quinn had asked it for me. If I am found worthy, I should very much like to be on the inside of it, said Fra Orlo, and then glanced at me with an amused look, as if he had guessed my thoughts. The point is that in 9 or so years I can expect to be summoned to the upper labyrinth which separates my math from that of the centenarians. There I shall find my way to a grate in a dark room, and on the other side of that grate shall be one of those hundreders, unless they have all died, vanished, or turned into something else, who shall ask me questions that shall seem just as queer to me as mine do to you. For they must make preparations for their abbot just as we do for ours. In their books they have records of every judicial practice that they and others in other consents have heard of in the last 3700 odd years. The list that I rattled off to you a minute ago is but a single paragraph from a book as thick as my arm. So even if you find it to be a ridiculous exercise, I should be most grateful if you'd simply describe to me how you choose your criminals.
Will my answer be entered in that book?
If it is a new answer, yes.
Well, we still have magistrate doctors who roam about at the new moon in sealed purple boxes.
Yes, those I remember.
But they weren't coming round as often as we needed them. The powers that be weren't doing a good job of protecting them, and some got rolled down hills. Then the powers that be put up more spiele captors.
Fra Orlo jumped to a new leaf. Who has access to those?
Well, we don't know.
Orlo began moving to yet another new leaf, but before he found it, Quinn continued.
But if someone commits a bad enough crime, the powers that be clamp a thing on their spine that makes them sort of crippled for a while. Later it falls off, and then they are normal again.
Does it hurt?
No.
A new page. When you see someone wearing one of those devices, can you tell what crime they committed?
Yes. It says right on it, in kinograms.
Theft? Assault? Extortion?
Sure.
Sedition? Quinn waited a long time before saying,
I've never seen that.
Heresy?
Well, that would probably be handled by the Warden of Heaven.
Fra Orlo threw his hands up so high that his bolt fell away from his head and even bared one of his armpits. Then he brought them down again, the better to clamp them over his face. It was a sarcastic gesture that he liked to make in a chalk hall when a fid was being impossibly blockheaded. Quinn clearly took its meaning and became embarrassed. He shifted back in his chair and pointed his chin at the ceiling, then lowered it again and looked at the window he was supposed to be mending. but there was something in Fra Orlo's huge gesture that was funny and gave Quinn the feeling that it was okay.
All right, Quinn finally said. I never thought of it like this, but now that you mention it, we have three systems.
The chaps in the purple boxes, the spying clamps, and this new thing that neither I nor Fra Erasmus has ever heard of called the Warden of Heaven, said Fra Orlo, and began pushing through many leaves of his questionnaire, digging deep. Something had occurred to Artisan Quinn.
I never mentioned them because I thought you'd know all about them.
Because, Fra Orlo said, finding the page he'd been looking for and scanning it, they claimed that they came from the Consent, bringing the enlightenment of the Mathic world to a worthy few.
Yeah, didn't they?
No, they didn't. Seeing just how taken aback Quinn was, Orlo continued, This sort of thing happens every few hundred years. Some charlatan will appear and make a claim on secular power based on an association with the Mathic world, which happens to be fraudulent. I knew the answer to the following question before I blurted it out. Does Artisan Fleck, is he a follower, a disciple of the Warden of Heaven? Quinn and Orlo both looked at me, agog for different reasons.
Yes, Quinn said. He listens to their casts while he works.
That's why he made a spiele of Provener, I said. Because this Warden of Heaven claims to be part of us. If there's anything mysterious, or, well, magnificent about this place, why, that just makes the Warden of Heaven seem that much bigger and more powerful. And to the extent that Artisan Fleck is a disciple of the Warden of Heaven, he feels some of that belongs to him. Orlo said nothing, which made me embarrassed at the time. When I thought about it later, though, I understood that he didn't need to say anything because what I'd said was obviously true. Quinn was looking a little confused.
Fleck didn't make a spiele.
I beg your pardon, I said. Fra Orlo was still distracted, thinking about the Warden of Heaven.
They wouldn't allow it. His spiele captor was too good, Quinn explained.
Being old and wise, Fra Orlo went rigid, pursed his lips, and looked uneasy. Being neither, I said, What on earth does that mean? Fra Orlo's hand came down on my wrist and prevented me from writing any more. And I suspect that his other hand wanted to clamp down on Quinn's mouth. Quinn went on,
The eagle res, the steady hand, the dinozoom, put those all together and it could have been seen straight across into the other parts of your minster, even through the screens. Or at least that's what he was told by the...
Artisan Quinn, Fra Orlo trumpeted, loud enough to draw looks from everyone else in the library. Then he made his voice quite low. I am afraid you are about to tell us something that your friend Fleck learned from talking to the Eta, and I must remind you that such a thing is not allowed under our discipline.
Sorry,
Quinn said.
It's confusing.
I know it is.
All right, forget about the Steely Captor. I'm sorry, where were we?
We were talking about the Warden of Heaven, Fra Orlo said, relaxing a little, and finally letting go my wrist. And as far as I'm concerned, the only thing we need to establish is whether he is a throwback-turned-mystagogue or a bottle-shaker, as the former can be quite dangerous.
Cephidocles 1. A Fid from the halls of Orithena, who survived the eruption of Ecba to become one of the 40 lesser peregrines. In his old age, he appears to have turned up on the Periclean, though some scholars believe that this must have been a son or namesake of the Orithenan. He appears as a minor character in several of the great dialogues, most notably Euryloebus, where his timely and long-winded interruption enables Telenes, who has been thrown back on his heels by the heavy sarcasm of his adversary, to recover his equilibrium, change the subject, and embark upon the systematic annihilation of Sphenic thought that accounts for the last third of the dialogue and culminates in the title character's public suicide. From the peregrine phase of Cephidocles's career, three dialogues survive, and from his years on the Periclean, eight. Though talented, he gives the impression of being insufferably smug and pedantic, whence sense two. 2. an insufferably smug or pedantic interlocutor. The Dictionary, 4th edition, AR 3000.
I can puzzle out throwback turned mystagogue, I told Fra Orlo later. I was chopping carrots in the refectory kitchen, and he was eating them. And I can even guess why they are dangerous. Because they're angry, they want to come back to the place that anathematized them, and even the score. Yes, and that's why Quinn and I spent the whole afternoon with the warden fendant. But what's a bottle shaker? Imagine a witch doctor in a society that doesn't know how to make glass. A bottle washes up on the shore. It has amazing properties. He puts it on a stick and waves it around and convinces his fellows that he has got some of those amazing properties himself. So bottle shakers aren't dangerous? No. Too easily impressed. What of the slines who ate Saint Bly's liver? Apparently they weren't so impressed. To hide a smile, Fra Orlo pretended to inspect a potato. The point is well taken, but remember that Saint Bly was living alone on a butte. The very fact of his having been thrown back separated him from the artifacts and aughts that are most impressive to bottle-shaker-producing societies. So what did you and the warden fendant decide? Fra Orlo glanced around in a way that made it obvious I should have been more discreet. Expect more precautions at Appert. I lowered my voice.
So the secular power will send, I don't know,
robots with stun guns, echelons of horse archers, cylinders of sleeping gas?
I guess so.
That depends on to what extent the Warden of Heaven has become the same as the Panjandrums, Fra Orlo said. He liked to call the secular power the Panjandrums. And that is very difficult for us to make out. Obviously, I can't make heads or tails of it. It is just the kind of thing for which the office of Warden Fendant was created, and I'm certain that Fra Degelos is working the problem as we speak.
Could it lead to, you know,
a sack? Local or general? I certainly don't think that this is going to culminate in number 4. Fra Degelos would have heard rumblings from other Wardens Fendant. Even a local sack is most improbable. I wouldn't be surprised to see a bit of roughhousing on 10th night, but that's why we prepare for Appert by moving all of the stuff we really care about to the labyrinths.
You said to Quinn that radical changes extramuros had twice culminated in sacks, I reminded him.
Fra Orlo let a moment go by and said, yes. Then, before I could go on, he put on the merry Fra face that he used when he was trying to humor a chalk hall full of bored fids. You're not actually worrying about number 4, are you? I murdered a carrot and said Dyax's rake 3 times under my breath. 3 sacks general in 3,700 years is not bad, he pointed out. The statistics for the secular world are far more alarming.
I was worrying about it a little bit, I said. But that is not what I was going to ask before you went Kephidocles on me.
Orlo said nothing, perhaps because I was gripping a large knife. I was tired and testy. Earlier, I had punched in my sphere to make it a bushel basket and ventured into the tangles nearest the cloister, only to find they'd already been stripped of produce. To find all the stuff we needed to make the stew, I'd had to cross the river and ransack some of the tangles between it and the wall. I snatched a hard-earned carrot and aimed it at the sky. You have only taught me of the stars, I said. History I have learned from others, mostly from Fra Corlandon.
He probably told you that the sacks were our fault, said Orlo,
using our, I noted, in a very elastic way, to mean every avowed all the way back to Ma Cartus. Sometimes when I was chatting with Thistlehead, he would reach out and give me a little push on the collarbone, and just like that I'd be flailing my arms, aware that one more push would topple me. It was Leo's charming way of letting me know that he had noticed I was standing in the wrong way, according to his books of veil lore. I thought it nonsense. But my body always seemed to argue with Fra Leo, because it would overreact. Once, in trying to recover my balance, I had pulled a muscle deep in my back
that had hurt for 3 weeks. Fra Orlo's last sentence touched my mind in a similar way. And in a similar way, I overreacted. My face flushed, and my heart beat faster. It was just like the moment in a dialogue when Telenes has tricked his interlocutor into saying something stupid and is about to begin slicing him up like a carrot on a plank. "Each sack was followed by a reform, was it not?" I said. "Let us rake your sentence and say that each sack led to changes in the maths that are still observed to this day." That Fra Orlo was now talking in this style confirmed that we were in dialogue. The other Fras stopped peeling potatoes and chopping herbs and gathered around to watch me get planed. "All right, call him whatever you wish," I said, then snorted, because I knew I had left myself open. This was the equivalent of me falling on my arse after one little nudge from Fra Leo. I should never have brought up Kephidocles. I was going to pay for that. I couldn't stop myself from shooting a glance out the window. The kitchen faced south into an herb garden that filled most of the space between it and the closest of the tangles, the ones cultivated by the very oldest Fras and Sures, so that they wouldn't have to walk very far to get their chores done. The roof on that side had a deep overhanging eave to prevent sun from shining in and making the kitchen even hotter than it already was. Sure Tullia and Sure Ayla were sitting together in the shade of that eave, directly beneath the window, cutting up tires to make sandals. I didn't want Tullia to hear me get planed because I had a crush on her, and I didn't want Ayla to hear it because she would enjoy it so much. Fortunately, they were explaining something to each other, as usual, and had no idea what was happening in here.
"Call them whatever you wish. What a curious thing to say, Fiderasmus," Orlo said. "Let me see. May I call them carrots or floor tiles?"
Titters flew out from all around, like sparrows flushed from a belfry. "No, Pa Orlo, it would not make sense to say that each sack was followed by a carrot."
"Why not, Fiderasmus?"
"Because the word carrot has a meaning different from reform or change in the maths."
"So because words have this remarkable property of possessing specific meanings, we must take care to use the correct ones? Is that a just statement of what you have said, or am I in error?"
"It is correct, Pa Orlo."
"Perhaps some of the others who have learned so much from the new circle and the reformed old Faunians have noted some error in this and would like to correct us."
And with the placid eye of a viper tasting the air, Fra Orlo looked about at the half-dozen Fids who had encircled us.
No one moved. "Very well. No one here wishes to support the novel hypothesis of Saint Proc. We may continue under the assumption that words mean things. What is the difference between saying that the sacks were followed by reforms and saying that they were followed by changes in the maths?"
"I suppose it has to do with the connotations of the word reform," I said. For I had given up and was willing to let myself be plained, not because I liked it, but because it was so unusual for Fra Orlo to expose his views about anything other than stars and planets.
"Ah, perhaps you would elaborate on that, for I am not gifted with your faculty for words, Fiderasmus, and would be chagrined if I failed to follow your argument."
"Very well, Pa Orlo. To say that there were changes seems like a more Dyaxan phrasing, raked clean of subjective emotional judgments, whereas when we say reforms, it gives the feeling that something was wrong with how the maths were run before and that
we deserved to be sacked. The Pangendrums needed to come in and mend us."
"When you put it that way, Pa Orlo, and in that tone of voice, you seem to suggest that the changes that were made need not have been, that they were forced on us wrongly by the secular power." I stumbled over a few words because I was excited. I had glimpsed a way to corner Orlo. For those reforms, those changes, were as fundamental to the maths as going to Provenor every day, and he could hardly take a stand against them. But Fra Orlo only shook his head sadly as if he could scarcely believe what thin gruel was being spooned out to us in the chalk halls.
You need to review the Seculum of St. Cartus.
Avout, who spent a lot of time peering through telescopes, were known for taking an eccentric approach to the study of history, and so I did not laugh at this. A few of the others exchanged smirks.
Pa Orlo, I read it last year.
What you read was probably selections from a translation into Middle Orth. Many of those translations were influenced by a sort of Procyon mentality that took hold during the Old Mathic Age, not long before the rise of the Mystagogues.
You giggle, but it is obvious once you begin to notice it. Certain bits of it they translate poorly because they are skittish about what it means. Then, when they get around to choosing selections, they leave those bits out because they're ashamed of them. Instead, you should go to the effort of reading Cartus in the original. It is not as difficult to follow Old Orth as some would have you believe.
And when I do this, what shall I learn?
That in the very founding document of the Mathic world, St. Cartus herself emphasizes that it is not an accommodation to the Seculum, but a kind of opposition to it, a counterbalance.
The consent is fortress mentality? Suggested one of the listeners, trying to bait Orlo.
That is not a designation I love, said Orlo. But if I hold forth on that, the stew will never get made, and we'll soon have 295 hungry avout calling for our heads. Suffice it to say, Fid Erasmus, the St. Cartus would never have accepted the notion that the secular power can or should reform the maths. But she would have admitted that it does have the power to wreak changes on us.
Proke. 1. A late Praxic Age meta-theorician who is assumed to have been liquidated in the terrible events. During the brief window of stability between the second and third harbingers, Proke was the leading figure in a like-minded group called the Circle, which claimed that symbols have no meaning at all, and that all discourse that pretends to mean anything is nothing more than a game played with syntax or the rules for putting symbols together. Following the reconstitution, he was made patron saint of the syntactic faculty of the consent of Saint Muncoster. As such, he is viewed as the progenitor of all orders that trace their descent to that faculty, as opposed to those originating from the semantic faculty, whose patron was Saint Helicarn. The Dictionary, 4th edition, AR 3000.
I understand that some planing took place in the kitchen.
Believe me, it was not one for ink or even chalk. Fra Corlandon, the FAE, first among equals of the Order of the New Circle, had sat down across the table from me. For the first 9 3/4 years of my time at the consent, he had ignored me, except in chalk hall where he was obliged to pay attention. Lately, he was acting as if we were friends. This was to be expected. With luck, 30 or 40 new avout would be joining us at Appert. Even though they were not here yet, they seemed to surround us like ghosts, which made me seem older by contrast. Not long after, if things went according to the usual pattern, the bells would signal the aught of Eliger, and all the tenors would come together to watch me take a vow that would bind me to one order or another. 11 of my crop had been collected, brought straight into the math from Extramuros. The other 21 had joined the Unarian math first and spent at least a year under their discipline before graduating to the tenors. They tended to be a little bit older than us collects. All collection, and most graduation, happened during Appert. Though if a one-off showed exceptional promise, he or she could graduate early by passing through the labyrinth that connected the Unarian to the Decenarian math. But this had only happened 3 times while I'd been here. The full wiring diagram of how avout came here from Extramuros and from small feeder maths in the region, and how they moved from one math to another, was complicated and not really worth explaining. The upshot was that in order to maintain our nominal strength of 300, we tenors would need to take in about 40 new people at Appert. Some, we couldn't know how many, would be graduating from the Unarian math. The balance would be made up by collection, and by trolling through hospitals and shelters for abandoned newborns. Once that was all done, I'd be facing a choice. Fra Corlandon was sounding me out, perhaps even recruiting me, for the new circle. I had always been seen as a fit of Orlo and a few other Edharians who assisted him in his theorics. They spent whole days together in tiny chalk halls, and when they came out, I would go in and see their handwriting all tangled together on the slates, snarled skeins of equations and diagrams of which I understood perhaps one symbol in 20. At this very moment, I was supposed to be working on a problem that Orlo had set for me, a photomnemonic tablet bearing an image of St. Tancred's nebula, from which I was supposed to answer certain questions about the formation of heavy nuclei in the cores of stars. Definitely not a new circle kind of exercise. So why would the new circle take it into their heads now that I might choose them at Eliger?
Orlo is an impressive theoretician, Fra Corlandon said. I regret that I haven't been souvened by him more.
The flaw in this was obvious. Odds were that Corlandon was going to spend 60 or 70 more years in the same math with Orlo. If he really meant what he said, why didn't he simply pick up his stew bowl and walk across the refectory to Orlo's table? Fortunately, my mouth was full of bread, and so I did not subject Fra Corlandon to a withering blast of Tillinean analysis. Chewing my food gave me time to realize that he was just speaking polite nothings. Edharians never talked this way. Spending all my time around Edharians, I had forgotten how to do it. I tried to unlimber those parts of my mind that were used for polite conversation. Probably a good thing to do anyway on Appert Eve.
I'm sure you could arrange to be souvened by Orlo if you sat down near him and said something wrong.
Fra Corlandon chuckled at my joke.
I'm afraid I don't know enough about the stars even to say something wrong.
Well, today, for once, he said something that wasn't about stars.
That's what I heard. Who could have guessed that our cosmographer was an enthusiast for dead languages?
This entire sentence went by me. A little like when you are eating a slice of canned fruit and suddenly it slides down your throat before you've had a chance to chew it. Having finally got the hang of polite chit-chat, I returned the favor of chuckling at his remark. But before I could really think about what he was saying, I noticed Leo and Jezri carrying their bowls to the kitchen. Two other Fids stood, as though caught up in their wake, and followed them. Following their glances, I noticed Grandsor Tamara standing by the exit, with her arms folded. She reacted as if I had hit her with a spitball from across a crowded chalk hall, swiveling her head to strafe me with her eyes. I still had no idea what was going on, but I excused myself from Fra Corlandon and carried my bowl into the kitchen. Seven of the other Fids were there, hurriedly cleaning their bowls, but none of them knew any more than I did.
Encanter. 1. A legendary figure associated in the secular mind with the mathic world, said to be able to alter physical reality by the incantation of certain coded words or phrases. The idea is traceable to work conducted in the mathic world prior to the third sack. It was wildly inflated in popular culture, where fictionalized encanters, supposedly linked to Halicarnian traditions, dueled their mortal foes, the Rhetors, supposedly linked to Protians, in more or less spectacular style. An influential Suvan among historical scholars holds that the inability of many seculars to distinguish between such entertainments and reality was largely responsible for the third sack. The Dictionary, 4th edition, AR 3000.
A few minutes later, all 32 Fids in Grandsor Tamara were together in St. Grode's Chalk Hall, which was normally considered to hold 18.
"Shall we move over to St. Venster, where there's more room?" suggested Sora Ayla.
She was the self-appointed boss of the bell-ringing team, and of everyone else in range of her searchlight eyes. Behind Ayla's back, people like to say that of all the current crop of Fids, she was the most likely to end up being warden regulant. Grandsor Tamara pretended not to hear. She had lived here 75 years and well knew the sizes of the available halls. She must have chosen this one for a reason. Probably, I realized, because no one could hide ignorance or boredom when we were packed in so tightly.
There wasn't room to make our spheres into stools, and so we kept them pilled up and tucked inside our bolts. I noticed that some of the Surs were standing even closer together than was strictly necessary and sniffling into one another's shoulders. One of them was Tulia, whom I liked quite a bit. I was 18. Tulia was a bit younger. Lately, I had dreamed of having a liaison with her once she had come of age. In general, I looked at her more often than was strictly necessary. Sometimes she looked back. But when I tried to meet her eye now, she pointedly looked away and fixed her red and swollen eyes on the big stained glass window above the slate. Since A, it was dark outside, and B, the window depicted Saint Grode and his research assistants being beaten with rubber hoses in the dungeons of some praxic age spy bureau, and C, Tulia had already spent something like a quarter of her life in this room, I reckoned that inspecting the window wasn't really the point. Dense though I am, I finally put it together that this was the last time that our crop of 32 Fids would be gathered together as such in our lives. The girls, with their preternatural ability for noticing such things, were responding. The boys, with our equally uncanny obtuseness, were only affected inasmuch as the girls we fancied were crying. Grand Sir Tamara was not doing this to be sentimental, though.
"Our topic is the iconographies and their origins," she announced. "If I am satisfied that you know enough and that you understand the importance of what you know, then you shall be free to roam about Extramuros during the 10 days of Apert. Otherwise, you shall remain in the cloister for your own safety. Fid Erasmus, what are the iconographies and why do we concern ourselves with them?"
Why had Grand Sir Tamara directed the first question at me? Probably because I'd been transcribing those interviews with Fra Orlo and had an advantage over the others. I decided to frame my answer accordingly.
"Well, the extras..."
"The seculars," Tamara corrected me.
"The seculars know that we exist. They don't know quite what to make of us. The truth is too complicated for them to keep in their heads. Instead of the truth, they have simplified representations, caricatures, of us. Those come and go, and have done since the days of Telenes. But if you stand back and look at them, you see certain patterns that recur again and again, like attractors in a chaotic system."
"Spare me the poetry," said Grand Sir Tamara with a roll of the eyes.
There was a lot of tittering, and I had to force myself not to glance in Tulia's direction. I went on.
"Well, long ago those patterns were identified and written down in a systematic way by Avout who make a study of Extramuros. They are called iconographies. They are important because if we know which iconography a given secular is carrying around in his head, we'll have a good idea what they think of us and how they might react to us."
Grand Sir Tamara gave no sign of whether she liked my answer or not, but she turned her eyes away from me, which was the most I could hope for.
"Fid Ostaban," she said,
staring now at a 21-year-old Fra with a ragged beard.
"What is the Temnestrian iconography?"
"It is the oldest," he began.
"I didn't ask how old it was."
"It's from an ancient comedy," he tried.
"I didn't ask where it was from."
"The Temnestrian iconography,"
he re-began.
"I know what it's called. What is it?"
"It depicts us as clowns,"
Fra Ostaban said, a little brusque.
"But clowns with a sinister aspect. It is a two-phase iconography. At the beginning, we are shown, say, prancing around with butterfly nets or looking at shapes in the clouds."
"Talking to spiders," someone put in.
Then, when no reprimand came from Grand Sir Tamara, someone else said,
"Reading books upside down."
Another, "Putting our urine up in test tubes." "So at first it seems only comical," said Fra Ostaban, regaining the floor. "But then in the second phase, a dark side is shown. An impressionable youngster is seduced, a responsible mother lured into insanity, a political leader led into decisions that are pure folly."
"It's a way of blaming the degeneracy of society on us," making us the original degenerates, said Grand Sir Tamara. Its origins, Fid Dulian?
The Cloud Weaver, a satirical play by the Etheran playwright Temnestra that mocks Telenes by name and that was used as evidence in his trial.
How to know if someone you meet is a subscriber to this iconography, Fid Ulf?
Probably they will be civil as long as the conversation is limited to what they understand, but they'll become strangely hostile if we begin speaking of abstractions.
Abstractions?
Well, let's say anything that comes to us from our mother Hylea.
Level of dangerousness on a scale of 1 to 10?
Given what happened to Telenes, I'd say 10.
Grand Sir Tamara didn't favor the answer.
I can't be too hard on you for overestimating the risk, but...
Telenes was executed in an orderly judicial proceeding by the secular power, not a mob action,
volunteered Leo.
And mob actions are less predictable, thus more difficult to defend against.
Very good, said Grand Sir Tamara,
obviously surprised to hear such a cogent answer coming from Leo.
So let us rate its level of danger as 8. Fid Halak, what is the origin of the Dox iconography?
A praxic age moving picture serial, an adventure drama about a military spaceship sent to a remote part of the galaxy to prevent hostile aliens from establishing hegemony and marooned when their hyperdrive is damaged in an ambush. The captain of the ship was passionate, a hothead. His second in command was Dox, a theorician, brilliant, but unemotional and cold.
Fid Jezri, what does the Dox iconography say of us?
That we are useful to the secular power. Our gifts are to be celebrated. But we are blinded or crippled, take your pick, by
the very same qualities that make us useful, said Fid Tulia.
Which was why I couldn't get her out of my mind. In a heartbeat, she could go from blubbering to being the cleverest person in the room.
How to identify one who is under the influence of the Dox iconography, Fid Tulia again?
They'll be curious about our knowledge, impressed by us, but patronizing, certain that we must be subordinated to intuitive common-sense leaders.
Danger level, Fid Branch?
I would put it very low. It is basically the situation we are living in anyway.
This got a laugh, which Grand Sir Tamara didn't like very much.
Fid Ayla, what does the your iconography have in common with the Dox?
Sir Ayla had to think for a minute before trying.
Also from a praxic age entertainment serial? But it was an illustrated book, wasn't it?
Later they made moving pictures of it, put in Fra Leo.
Someone muttered a hint into Ayla's ear, and then she remembered everything.
Yes, your is identified as a theorician, but if you see how he actually spends his time, he's really more of a praxic. He has turned green from working with chemicals, and he has a tentacle sprouting from the back of his skull, always wears a white laboratory smock. Criminally insane, always has a scheme to take over the world.
Fra Arcibald, what iconography surrounds the Rhetors?
He was so ready.
Fiendishly gifted at twisting words and confusing seculars, or what is worse, influencing them in ways so subtle they don't even know it's happening. They use Unarian maths to recruit and groom minions, whom they send out into the secular world to get influential positions as burghers, but in truth, they are all puppets of a Rhetor conspiracy.
Well, that one makes sense anyway, said Fid Ulf.
Everyone looked at him to make out whether he was joking. He looked taken aback.
Guess we know which order you'll be signing up for,
said one irritated Sur, who everyone knew was headed for the new circle.
Because he's a Prokean hater? Or just because he's socially inept?
Said one of her companions in a low voice that was, however, clearly audible.
That's enough, said Grand Sur Tamara. The seculars don't know about the differences between our orders, and so all of us, not just the Prokeans, are equally vulnerable to the iconography that Fra Arcibald has just explained. Let's move on.
And so it went. The Muncoster iconography. Eccentric, lovable, disheveled theorician, absent-minded, means well. The Pennock iconography. A high-strung, nervous, meddling know-it-all who simply doesn't understand the realities,
lacking physical courage, he always loses out to a more masculine character. The Clevin iconography, Theor as an awesomely wise elder statesman who can solve all the problems of the secular world. The Bod iconography, we are grossly cynical frauds living in luxury at the expense of the common man. The Penthabrian, we are guardians of ancient mystical secrets of the universe handed down to us by Canoas himself, and all of our talk about Theorix is just a smokescreen to hide our true power from the unwashed multitude. In all, there were around a dozen iconographies that Grand Sor Tamora wanted to talk about. I'd heard of all of them, but I hadn't realized that there were so many until she made us sort through them one by one. Particularly interesting was the rating of their relative dangers. After much back and forth, we concluded that the most dangerous of the lot was not the Yor, as one might have expected, but rather the Moshianic, which was a hybrid of the Clevin and the Penthabrian. It held that we were going to emerge from the gates and bring enlightenment to the world and usher in a new age. It tended to peak every 100 or 1,000 years as people got ready for the centenarian or millenarian gates to open. It was dangerous because it raised people's expectations to the point of delirium and drew many pilgrims and much attention. Because of my work with Fra Orlo, I knew that the Moshianic iconography was ascendant, in the guise of the so-called Warden of Heaven. Our hierarchs had become aware of this, and the Warden Fendant had asked Grand Sor Tamora to lead us in this discussion. In the end, she gave the whole crop permission to go extramuros tomorrow, which surprised no one. The threat of locking us up had only been to make us pay heed. The discussion had actually become quite interesting, and the only thing that ended it was the ringing of the curfew bell. It was part of our discipline never to sleep two nights in a row in the same cell. Assignments were posted each evening on a slate in the refectory. We had to go back there to find out where we'd be sleeping and whom we'd be chumming with. So the entire group made its way out of the chalk hall and around the cloister, chattering and laughing about Docs and Yor and the other funny characters that the extras had dreamed up in an effort to make sense of us. Older Fras and Soors sat on the benches that faced into the cloister, assembling sandals, normally our sort of job, in giving us dirty looks. It was important that I not let any one of the sandal makers catch my eye, so I looked elsewhere. I noticed Fra Orlo emerging from one of the other chalk halls with a sheaf of leaves, cluttered with calculations, tucked under his arm. He started one way, then, seeing our crowd, turned into the garden instead, and headed off in the direction of the minster. This gave me a little twinge, for a certain tablet of Saint Tancred's Nebula was gathering dust on a table in a workroom up in the Starhenge, holding down a couple of leaves stained with inconclusive notes and scratch-outs in my handwriting. Orlo would notice, and know I hadn't worked on it in days. A few minutes later I was in the cell that I was to share that night with two other Fras, wrapping myself up in my bolt and making my sphere a pillow. You might expect that as I lay there trying to get to sleep, I'd be thinking about Appert or about the iconographies. But spying Fra Orlo in the cloister had put me in mind of the slippery sentence that Fra Corlandon had spoken at dinner, and that I had swallowed without tasting. Now it had become one of those unwelcome thoughts I didn't know how to get rid of. "That's what I heard," Fra Corlandon had said. But my dialogue with Orlo had taken place only an hour before dinner. Who among the spectators had run off to spread the story in the new Circle chapter house? Why did anyone care? Until last year, Corlandon had been in a liaison with Sor Trustinus, also of the new Circle. Then one day the bells had rung to signal the Aught of Regrid, meaning that someone had made the decision to go into retirement. We had convened in the minster and the primate had called out a name, that of our Warden Regulant. Despite all of the penance that this man had meted out to us over the years, we all felt sorrow as we sang the chants of the Aught, for he had been reasonable and wise. Statho, the primate, had then named Sor Trustinus the new Warden Regulant. It was a little bit of a surprise because she was young, but not controversial since everyone knew she was bright. She had moved to the primate's compound, where she now had a cell to herself and took her meals with the other hierarchs. But rumor had it
that her liaison with Fra Corlandon continued. Some avowed, of a suspicious mindset, believed that the hierarchs had devices salted around the consent that enabled them to know what we were saying. Believing so was a fad that came and went, depending on what people thought of the hierarchs at a given time. It had been on the rise since Sor Trustinus had been appointed Warden Regulant. It was impossible for me not to think of it now. Perhaps she had listened to my dialogue with Orlo, and later passed it on to Corlandon. On the other hand, said the part of my mind that pleaded with such thoughts to go away, I had to admit that I myself had thought it strange that Orlo would suddenly take an interest in old Orth translation errors. Who could have guessed that our cosmographer was an enthusiast for dead languages? Well, enthusiast was one of those unkillable words that had passed almost unchanged from Proto-Orth all the way up into Fluckish. In Fluckish, which was how I assumed at first Corlandon had used it, it simply meant one who liked something. The Proto-Orth meaning, however, was not a very complimentary one to hang on a Fra, especially a theoretician like Orlo. And dead languages, too, was an interesting choice of words. Was it really dead if Orlo was reading it? And if Orlo was right about the translations, then by calling the original dead, wasn't Corlandon sort of making a point? And doing it in a sneaky way without going to the effort of proving it? After what seemed like hours of lying awake and worrying about this, I had the upside that the things Fra Orlo said, even when they caused me embarrassment or outright pain, never made me wrestle with my bolt in the nighttime in the way that these words from Fra Corlandon had. This made me think I'd rather join the Edharians. If, that is, the Edharians would have me. I was not so confident that they would. I'd never been as quick to grasp pure theorics as some of the other Fids. This must have been noticed. I wondered, why had Grand Sor Tamara asked me the first and easiest question? Was it because she didn't think I could handle anything more difficult? Why did Orlo have me working as an amanuensis instead of doing theorics? Why was Corlandon now trying to recruit me? Putting it all together, the conclusion seemed to be that everyone knew I just wasn't fit to join the Edharian Order, and some were trying to prepare a soft landing for me.
Part 2. Appert.
Eta. 1. In late Praxic Orth, an acronym. Therefore, in ancient texts, sometimes written capital I, capital T, capital A, whose precise etymology is a casualty of the loss of shoddily preserved information that will forever enshroud the time of the harbingers and the terrible events. Almost all scholars agree that the first two letters come from the words information technology, which is late Praxic Age commercial bullshit for syntactic devices. The third letter is disputed. Hypotheses include authority, associate, arm, archive, aggregator, amalgamated, analyst, agency, and assistant. Each of these, of course, suggests a different picture of what role the Eta might have performed in the years before the reconstitution, and so each tends to be advocated by a different Suven. 2. In early New Orth, up to the second sack, a faculty of a consent devoted to the praxis of syntactic devices. 3. In later New Orth, a prescribed artisanal caste tolerated in the 37 consents that were built around the great clocks, all of which are in technical violation of the second sack reforms in that their clocks were built with subsystems that employ syntactic devices. The task of the Eta is to operate and maintain these subsystems while observing strict segregation from the avowed. The Dictionary. 4th edition, AR 3000.
The last night of 3689, I dreamed that something was troubling Frau Orlo, and that everyone had noticed, but on no account would he or anyone else speak of it openly. So it was a mystery, and yet everyone knew what it was. The planets were deviating from their courses, and the clock was wrong. For part of the clock was an orrery, a mechanical model of the solar system that displayed the current positions of the planets and many of their moons. It was in the narthex, or lobby, between the day gate and the north nave. It had been exactly correct for 34 centuries, but now it had gone out of whack. The marble, crystal, steel, and lapis spheres that represented the planets had moved to positions that were at odds with what Frau Orlo could plainly see, even in the smallest of telescopes. Never mentioned in the dream, but understood by me, was that the problem must have something to do with the Eta, because the orrery was one of the systems driven by the devices that they tended in the vaulted cavern beneath the floor of the minster. The same system, it was rumored, effected subtle corrections to the rate of the main clock. If the error down in the cellar were not fixed, it would lead to greater errors that would be obvious to all, such as the bells chiming midday when the sun was not at its zenith, or the day gate opening before or after sunrise. In a universe governed by the usual logic, those errors would have cropped up later than the tiny discrepancies between the orrery and the planets. But in dream logic, it all happened at the same time, so that I was wondering what was troubling Frau Orlo, even as I saw the orrery show the phase of the moon wrong, which happened at the same time as burghers were wandering in through the day gate at midnight. But for some reason, none of those errors troubled me as much as the sounds emanating from the belfry, the bells ringing the wrong changes. I opened my eyes to hear Appert ringing. Or so the other Fras in my cell speculated. There was no way of telling unless you listened carefully for a few minutes. The belfry movement could play fixed tunes, for example, to chime the hours. But to announce aughts and other events, our team of ringers would disengage that mechanism and ring changes or permutations of tones. There was a pattern or code in them that we were taught to understand. This was supposedly so that messages could be cast to a sprawling consent without the people extramuros knowing what was being said. Not that there was anything secret about Appert. This was the first day of 3690. Therefore, not only the day gate, but the Unarian and the Decenarian gates would open at sunrise. Any extra who glanced at a calendar knew this perfectly well, and so did we. But for some reason, none of us would get out of bed and act upon it until we heard the right sequence of tones ring out from the belfry. A melody reversed, flipped upside down, and turned back on itself in a particular way. We sat up, three naked Fras in a cold cell with our bolts and cords and spheres all disheveled on the pallets. Such a day called for a formal rap, which was difficult to manage alone. Fra Holbein's feet had touched the floor first, so I leaned over and rummaged through his warm, stirred-up bolt until my fingers felt the fraying end, which I drew toward me. Fra Arcibalt, the third one in the cell, was the last to wake up. After some strong language from me and Holbein, he finally took up the selvage end. We went out into the corridor and stretched it between us. Fra Holbein had made it short, thick, and fuzzy for warmth. Arcibalt and I pleated Holbein's bolt and then backed away from each other as Holbein made it three times as long and much thinner. Cord wadded in his hand, he crawled under it and then stood up so that it was tented over his left shoulder. Then all he had to do was swivel this way and that and raise and lower his arms at the right times, while Arcibalt and I moved about him like planets in an orrery, winding the bolt, spreading or bunching pleats as necessary. The finished wrap was notoriously unstable, so we held it in place for a minute while Holbein passed his cord over it in several places and tied a few important knots. Then he was free to partner with Arcibalt in getting my bolt around me. Finally, Holbein and I did for Arcibalt. Arcibalt always liked to go last, so that he would get the best results. Not that he was vain. On the contrary, of all of our crop, he seemed best suited to live in a math. He was big and portly and kept trying to grow a beard so that he could look more like the old Fra that he was destined to be.
But unlike, say, Fra Leo, who invented new raps all the time, Archibald insisted on having it done right. When we were all clothed, we spent a few more minutes making extra passes with our cords and shaping the pleats that hooded our heads, just about the only part of this rap where it was possible to show any individual style. Completed sandals were heaped on the ground next to the exit of the cell house. I kicked through them looking for a pair big enough for my feet. The discipline had been created by people who lived in warm places. It allowed each of the avowed to own a bolt, a cord, and a sphere, but it said nothing about footwear. That didn't trouble us much during the summer, but the weather was getting ready to turn cold. And during Appert, we might go extramuros and walk on city streets with broken glass and other hazards. We stretched the discipline a little bit, wearing tire sandals during Appert and soft-soled mucklucks during the winter months. The avowed of Saint Edhar had been doing this for a long time now, and the Inquisition hadn't come down on us yet, so it seemed that we were safe. I made a pair of sandals mine and tied them onto my feet. Finally, each of us took his sphere and made it fist-sized. As we strolled in the direction of the minster, we passed the knotted ends of our cords around these, weaving simple nets to entrap them, then made the spheres inhale and swell to draw the cords taut. Each of us then made his sphere glow with a soft scarlet light. The light was so that we could see where we were going, and the color was to mark ourselves as tenors, which was necessary since before long we'd be mixed up with one-offs. When all of these preparations were finished, the sphere dangled from the right hip and swung against the thigh, which looked fascinating when a couple of hundred of us were converging on the minster in the dark. If you wanted to look like a real saint in a statue, you could cup the glowing sphere in one hand and stroke it with the other while staring off into the distance as though mesmerized by the light of Canoas. 40 avowed had risen earlier and gathered in the chancel. They were singing the processional of decennial Appert as we came in. Woven into this chant was a melody I had not heard in 10 years, or since I had stood inside the decade gate at sunrise and watched its stone and steel doors grind shut on everything I had ever known. To hear that melody now penetrated so deep into my brain that it literally threw me off balance, and I leaned into another fra. Leo, who for once did not use it as an excuse to flip me over his hip bone and slam me to the ground, but rather pushed me back up straight, as if I were a crooked icon, and turned his attention back to the aught. All of the music was synchronized to the clock, which served as metronome and conductor. It went on for another quarter of an hour. No reading, no homily, just music. The sky was clear, and so at the moment of sunrise, light washed down the well from the quartz prism at the top of the Starhenge. The music stopped. We extinguished our spheres. I had an impression that the light from above was emerald-colored at first, or perhaps that was a trick of my eyes. By the time I had blinked once, it had gone the color of the back of your hand when you shine a light through it in a dark cell. There was an unbearable moment of stillness when we all feared that, as in my dream, the clock was wrong and nothing would happen. Then the central weight began to drop. This happened every day at sunrise to open the day gate, but today it was the signal for everyone to crane their necks and look up to where the Presidium's pillars pierced the minster's vault. We heard, then saw movement. It was happening. Two of the weights were descending, riding down their rails to open the year gate and the decade gate. We all gasped and exclaimed and cheered, and many of us had to wipe our eyes. I could even hear the thousanders reacting to it behind their screen. The cube and the octahedron descended into plain view and everyone roared. We applauded them as if they were celebrities at an awards ceremony. As they neared the chancel floor, we hushed, as if fearing that they might smash into the ground. But as they got closer, they slowed and finally crept to a halt only a hand's breadth above the floor. Then we all laughed. In some ways, this was ridiculous. The clock was but a mechanism.
It had no choice at this moment but to let those weights drop. Yet to see it happen created a feeling that can't be conveyed to one who is not there. The choir was supposed to break into polyphonic singing now, and they almost couldn't. The raggedness of their voices was a music of its own. Outside, beneath the singing, I could hear the sound of running waters.
Avowed. 1. A person who has sworn a vow to submit himself or herself to the Cartesian discipline for one or more years, a fra or sur. 2. A plurality of such persons. 3. A formally constituted community of such persons, e.g., a chapter or a math. The Dictionary, 4th edition, AR 3000.
There's no right way to build a clock, Fra Corlandon used to say when he was teaching us modern post-reconstitution history. This was his euphemistic way of saying that St. Edhar's praxics had been a little bit crazy. Our consent was nestled in the crook of a river where it dodged around one end of a range of rocky bluffs, the terminus of a mountain range that stretched for hundreds of miles to the northeast and whose glaciers and snowpacks formed the river's headwaters. Just upstream was a series of cataracts. We could hear them at night if the slines weren't making too much noise. Below them, the river, as though resting from all the excitement, ran still and gentle for some distance, curving across a well-drained prairie. Part of that prairie and a mile and a half of the river were encompassed by our walls. Up at the cataract, the river was easily bridged, and so a settlement tended to be there. During some eras, it would grow and engulf our walls, and office workers and skyscrapers would gaze down on the tops of our bastions. At other times, it would ebb and recede to a tiny fueling station or gun emplacement at the river crossing. Our stretch of the river was hazardous, with rust-eaten girders and lumps of moss-covered synthetic stone, the remains of bridges that had been raised at that crossing and, in later ages, collapsed and washed downstream. Most of our land and almost all of our buildings were on the inside of the riverbend, but we had claimed a strip on the far bank and built our fortifications there. Walls parallel to the river where it ran straight, bastions where it bent. 3 of those bastions housed walls, one each for the unarian, decenarian, and centenarian maths. The millenarian gate was up on the mountain and worked differently. Each gate was supposed to swing open and closed at certain times. This had posed a problem for the praxics in that the gates were situated far away and on the opposite side of a river from the clock that was supposed to command the opening. The praxics had done it with water power. Far outside of our walls, upstream of the cataract, therefore at an altitude well above our heads, they had carved a pool, like an open cistern, out of the river's stony course, and made it feed an aqueduct that cut due south toward the Minster, bypassing the cataract, the bridge, and the bend. After rushing through a short tunnel and loping on stone stilts across half a mile of broken terrain, this dove into the ground and became a buried pipe that passed beneath what was now a settled neighborhood of burghers. The water in that pipe, pressurized by gravity, erupted in a pair of fountains from the pond that lay just outside of the day gate. A causeway ran across the middle of that pond, connecting the central square of the burghers' town at its northern end to our day gate at its southern, and passing right between those two fountains. The elevation of the pond was still above that of the river and plain. Drains were plumbed into its bottom and throttled by monumental ball valves of polished granite. One of them fed a series of ponds, canals, and fountains that beautified the primate's compound, and farther downstream formed part of the barrier between the unarian and the decenarian maths. 3 other drains were connected to systems of pipes, siphons, and aqueducts that ran out toward the year, decade, and century gates. Those systems were dry, except at Appert. Now the clock's descending weights had opened 2 valves and allowed water to rush from the pond to flood the year and decade systems. In some ways, maybe this was a crazy and ramshackle way to do it, But there was one advantage that wasn't obvious to me until that day. The waterworks had been designed to fill up slowly. So after the rite concluded, we were able to spill out of the minster and follow the water at a brisk walking pace as it charged an aqueduct that ran along beside the seven stairs, skirted the cloister, and reached across the back toward the river. A stone bridge crossed the river there, anchored on the near bank by a round tower, and on the far by a bastion in the convent's outer wall. Within the round tower was a cistern, now being filled by water from the aqueduct, with a pitcher lip poised above the petals of a water wheel. Most of us reached it in time to see the cistern overflow and the wheel begin to turn, accepting energy from the water before exhausting it into the river. By stainless steel gears, the wheel rotated a shaft as thick as my thigh that ran across the bridge. You might mistake it for a very stout railing if you didn't know what it was for. Across the river, inside of the bastion, the shaft drove another set of gears that was connected directly to the gates. Hearing them move, we ran toward them, but slowed as we got closer, not knowing what was about to happen. Well, actually, we had a pretty good idea, but I was still young enough that I could let myself forget about Dyax's rake when I was in love with some idea. Orlo's yarn about a math that floated freely in time, surfing on cross-currents of causal domain shear, had really stirred my emotions, and so for a few moments I let my imagination run away and pretended that I lived in such a math and that I really had no idea what might be found outside its gates when they opened. Mobs of jumped-up slimes rushing in with pitchforks or Molotovs. Starving ones crawling in to worry potatoes out of the ground. Moshianic pilgrims expecting to see the face of some god or other. Corpses strewn to the horizon. Virgin wilderness. The most interesting moment was when the gap between the gates grew just wide enough to admit a single person. Who would it be? Male or female, old or young, carrying an assault rifle, a baby, a chest of gold, or a backpack bomb.